The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Bigfoot North with your hosts, Todd Standing and Dr. Jeff Meldrum. Our show explores the remote, unknown wildernesses of the world to discover new species of relic hominids, considered by many to be the most man-like primates on the planet. Now, here are the hosts of Bigfoot North, Todd Standing and Dr. Jeff Meldrum.
Good day, everyone. I'm Todd Standing. Today on our show, we have somebody I'm a big fan of. I've always looked up to his work. He's written several books on the subject of Sasquatch. It's Dr. John Bitternagle. Thanks for coming on our show today, Dr. Bitternagle.
Hi, Todd. Thanks very much. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, John.
So, like we always do, I'd like to get right into it. I've actually spent time with both of you in the field, so it was spectacular having you come out to one of my research sites last year, John. I learned so much about you. It was amazing. I guess first I'd like to start off the show with, why do you live, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself and why you live in Vancouver Island specifically.
Okay. I'll try to keep this brief. Yeah, I'm a wildlife biologist by profession. I grew up basically in Eastern Canada, Ontario. Almost around the world with United Nations for a number of years earlier on in my profession. And then when it came time to settle, by which time I had developed an interest in the Sasquatch, I chose Vancouver Island as a nice place to live, lots of wildlife, and some Sasquatch sightings to follow up on.
And I thought it was interesting, too, because, when I talked to you about it, and I think you've really convinced me and made me into a believer. I feel, as you said, one of the most likely places or one of the best habitats in North America would be Vancouver Island. Maybe talk a little bit more about that, if you don't mind.
Well, yes, I think the whole western coast of North America, from sort of maybe northern Oregon through Washington, certainly all of British Columbia, including Vancouver Island, both sides, up into southeast Alaska. One day, when we finally accept the Sasquatch as existing, I think we'll find that this is by far the richest habitat, where they have the smallest home range, where it's relatively easy for them to persist. And we have some evidence of that just by the success of Aboriginal people on the coast, having done so very well here and had time to develop art.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Exactly.
Maybe
that area.
Go ahead, Jeff.
That area you're describing, John, is classed as temperate rainforest, if I'm remembering correctly. And what I found interesting as I was looking more into that habitat is that it's estimated that our current temperate rainforests in North America represent just a fraction, perhaps less than 10% of the extent of that habitat previously, back prior to the Pleistocene, probably. And I can't help but wonder if perhaps that isn't the primary habitat, the core habitat for this wild man of the woods.
Interesting. Good point. Yeah, might well be. Eh?
So what got you into the whole Bigfoot phenomena, John?
Well, it's a bit of a story, but again, I'll try to make it brief. I'm in third year university, 1963, back at the University of Guelph. And Ivan Sanderson had written an article in Argosy magazine about what we now refer to as the William Rowe account of 1955, when William Rowe saw this so-called ape man. Anyway, good article. Obviously, Argosy magazine is not a scientific magazine, but it was a respectable outdoor magazine in its day. Anyway, I raised it in a university class, third year, and said, gee, what about this ape man? Well, we get this kind of smirking laughter from the professor who says, "Oh, we can't possibly discuss that here. You know, we have to." And then of course my classmates all laugh because you know I've made a fool of myself, and then we go on, you know, to the normal stuff of wolves, moose, deer. But, you know, it kind of got my back up because I was about, 20 years old at the time. And at that time of life, young students in science are still somewhat idealistic. And I thought, gee, can we not be more open-minded than this? Well, at the time, there was almost nothing available in the literature, except a little bit of stuff on Yeti. But a few years later, late 60s and early 70s, John Green's books had come out. And there's a next step there in that I was able to get those books. And that kind of cinched it, and that's what actually led to me coming out here.
Now, since you're a scientist, I know you're very hands-on about things. What's the first piece of evidence that really, I mean, do you believe in Sasquatch? I mean, you wrote a book called The Discovery of Sasquatch. You're more of a, I'd call you a knower in it, wouldn't you? Or maybe explain that, your position on how you feel about the reality of this species is.
Okay. As you may know, I try to avoid that word being believing in, and I say this is an evidence-based conclusion. I find the evidence compelling, and therefore I have been convinced by the evidence. And it's very interesting because when we did move to British Columbia in 1975 to start a career here, I had to be, I chose to be very quiet about my interest in the Sasquatch because I wanted to be employable and be respectable, and it was and remains actually a taboo subject amongst wildlife biologists here. But in 1988, my wife and I actually found fresh tracks in the mountains near here, and amazingly, I mean, we got to make some really nice casts, and the casts were sitting on my desk from then on. But amazingly, I still did not become fully involved in this. I'd been doing interviews and, you know, just basically generating files on them. But it took those casts and a little more time before I actually started devoting. Oh, gee. Well, now of course it's pretty much full time, but it got increasingly more time devoted to this.
Have you seen those tracks, Jeff?
I have had the privilege of looking at those very carefully, and yeah, they're quite impressive. It's it's interesting how we both sort of became hooked on this, and in some ways, John, excuse me if I put thoughts in your mouth, but for me anyway, having had that experience with footprints firsthand in the field really was kind of a touchstone. I mean, that was an anchor for the commitment to pursue this question, at least for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, me too.
So, you've written two books, John. Maybe tell me a little about the two books that you've written so far.
Well, you know, it's almost a sore point because I feel they've been such failures. But the first one, I really thought I was doing a service by pulling together Sasquatch anatomy, behavior, and a little bit of ecology. And what I thought I was doing, this was the first book called North America's Sasquatch, The Great Ape. I showed how ape-like, you know, the anatomy was, and also the behavior. And I really thought, you know, gee, I'm pulling together a lot of this disparate data and evidence that which should be helpful to people. Well, it was essentially ignored, especially by the scientific community, and that's when I came to the discovery, the awareness that I had described the anatomy and behavior of an animal not yet considered to have been discovered. Hence, some years later, the second book, which I spent 7 years on, anyway, yeah, The Discovery of the Sasquatch. And this, that was a pretty exciting 7 years academically and sort of intellectually, because there I was looking at the discovery process of the Sasquatch and basically seeing, why is this discovery so prolonged? Why can we not move on to acknowledging the discovery of the Sasquatch? So it hasn't been particularly successful as a book, but it was a very fruitful period for me in the writing of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think they're both very substantial contributions to literature. You know, as an anthropologist, I was impressed that that you were able to navigate that that literature in a specialty that was, you know, outside of your principal sphere, and do it extremely expertly. I mean, no one would ever suspect that you weren't extremely versed and career-wise had grown up familiar with that that body of literature. And it was very helpful for me to orient my thinking to that point of view that we were dealing probably almost certainly with a large primate, a large ape, as opposed to something much more akin to the human family.
And likewise
the second book, I mean, I point to that repeatedly as a model of the the frustration, the frustration, the challenge, not frustration on your part, but just the frustration of trying to deal with a phenomenon that the ideological skeptics such as Michael Shermer state is unscientific until you have a body, which is the most unscientific statement that I've ever heard. But in any case, that it does a really good job of showing the epistemology of the subject, how it is that we gain that knowledge, how the ongoing process and struggle to try to find a place for these this body of data in the absence of conclusive, definitive proof.
Good. Well, thanks, Jeff. That's very very helpful. It's encouraging, especially coming from you. Yeah. I do make the point. That we're merely at this point still merely trying to attract the attention of our scientific colleagues. To the evidence. Yeah. Anyway.
Right.
Yeah. Frustration is a good word on several levels.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's almost a cliche throughout history. Everybody who's ever done anything great always was faced with these really profound challenges. So, and even I mean, this body of work that you did, John, it's absolutely wonderful. The book is amazing. Anybody I've talked to about the book just has nothing but great things to say about it. You have and when you talk about ignored, I'm a little confused. Even you had Dr. Jane Goodall spoke of it. George Shallard.
Yeah. Well, I got a few endorsements. Right. Thanks. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, it's wonderful. And, although I understand the importance of it, too, in that it's a hypothesis has to be theorized before you can go and, disprove or prove it. Because there's a few points in your book that we've talked about, like the nose example that you talk about, where it's you talk about the nose being more like a gorilla or a chimpanzee. And I see it as more of like a man's nose that comes out. It's those discussions that start up really important points that need to be discussed.
Yeah, actually, that is a good point because these questions do remain. I've heard many witnesses talk about these outward facing nostrils, and now I see your video of the face, and it's not like that at all. I'm thinking, my goodness, is there variation? Is one of us wrong? It's an open question, and will probably remain so for a while.
So, John, as a point of clarification, we talked about this back when Robert Bateman's painting of the British Columbia Sasquatch, graced the pages of beautiful BC in the article that you wrote, that very, very nice article. And that was one of my first reactions when I saw Bateman's painting, is he had given it a very pondered nose, and we were discussing that, and you had made the comment that much of your eyewitness testimony seemed to point in that direction. But yet, when I go through your book, The Discovery of Sasquatch, which I did just a few minutes before the program to refresh my memory on it, under anatomical features and the nose, the only two or three times that it's mentioned, it's rather ambiguous, because it's typically described as flat and broad. Now, when you use the term flat and broad, does that mean, are you implying forward-directed nostrils, or just a nose that has very little protruding bridge?
Well, near as I can tell, and I'm just referring to eyewitnesses here, Yes, flat and broad, and with basically an outward-facing nostrils, which keeps coming up. Unfortunately, I did not have that kind of detailed input when Robert Bateman did the painting. It was kind of sent to me as a fait accompli.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
And I also I'm not even sure if at that time, I'm not sure when that was, if I had some of the more recent reports describing the nose. So it wasn't something that I really picked up on then.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because, you know, there have been different interpretations of the Patterson-Gimlin film, that one particular frame that probably, that has been, dispersed, disseminated so widely that it has that very Neanderthaloid face and the very distinctive lips, which can't be seen in any other frame or any other copy of the film or any other single frame, versus Owen Caddy's analysis of the facial features, where, like you, he interpreted a much more forward-directed set of nostrils, and it's interesting. There's also a book that is written by Bauman, and I can't see it on my shelf just at the moment. But inside is a large painting that apparently Ron Olson commissioned. Ron Olson of the the North American Wildlife Association, which was the organization that succeeded Roger Patterson's Northwest Research Association. Mm-hmm. And it has this interesting interpretation of the Patterson-Gimlin film subject, and it has the nostrils directed straight forward. So there, it is interesting how there's... And yet when Roger Patterson, of course, that is the cover of his book, predated the film, but he has that rather flat, broad, more negroid shape of a nose, which sometimes has more forward directed nostrils, but certainly not the pushed back appearance of a pongid nose. So you're absolutely right. It's an interesting conversation, and we'll not know for sure until definitive videographic or photographic imagery is provided.
Right. Good.
Certainly not Rick Dyer's example.
Well, and I would contest that there's my footage, right? And all my footage, everything that I've ever filmed, it's always been with the nostrils, very, very human-like. And in fact, with all the people that I've interviewed over the years and spoken to, I have not met anybody who's had a sighting that didn't show me those same sort of, the nostrils that match the Sasquatch that I've filmed. So, interesting topic.
I think that's a good point, because all of us, all we investigators, our conception of the Sasquatch is based on the eyewitness accounts we've heard or that people have drawn for us or whatever, And although they add up, it's still a very limited number. And what I've heard is a different group of people probably than what you've heard and what Jeff's heard. And so, we come to something, and it may not be in agreement for good reason.
So we're going to take a short break here, but I actually have a really good question, and I think I'd like you to answer after the break, John. You told me that you did potentially have a Sasquatch sighting, so I'd like to talk about that a little bit more when we come back after the break here on Bigfoot North with Todd Standing and Jeff Meldrum. Guest today is John Bitternagel. When we come back.
The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com.
The Jane Goodall Institute is an organization dedicated to continuing to protect critical habitat for chimpanzees and other great apes in Africa. To work with and empower African communities to improve their lives, and to encourage young people around the world to take positive action for the planet. Go to janegoodall.org to sign a petition, get educated, and help to ensure great apes have a future on our amazing planet. That's janegoodall.org.
There are over 140 million products manufactured worldwide.
It is impossible to know the ingredients in these products, especially those made overseas. Stan Salat Jr., President and CEO of the HSF Mark and the Counterfeit Mark Alliance, is the host of People to People, working together for your safety. Stan believes in our right to know the type and amount of hazardous materials in consumer products and whether they are counterfeit. Find out how you can protect yourself every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern on Voice America Variety. The Complete Sylvanic Collection is an online download featuring videos, stills, chronicles, and audio collected by Todd Standing. It is an enormous collection of some of the most significant evidence ever recorded. Visit sylvanic.com or bigfootnorth.com to see these downloads, video footage, and to find out more about Todd's work. You can also find the Bigfoot North products for sale in the online store. Our sightings are just the beginning. Visit sylvanic.com or bigfootnorth.com and see what you're missing. The Internet's number one talk station.
Number one talk station.
VoiceAmerica.com. You are listening to Bigfoot North. If you have a comment about our program or a question for Todd Standing or Dr. Jeff Meldrum, please send an email to info@bigfootnorth.com. That's info@bigfootnorth.com. Now, back to the show.
All right, excellent. We're back. And now, so continuing on with the question, John, about your potential Sasquatch sighting. Give us your background and tell us what happened, please.
Okay, well, I know both of you, and I think many of the listeners as well are aware of the Erickson Project, Adrian Erickson, who funded a project back east. I don't know how much he divulges about the location, but anyway, it's in an eastern state. And he offered me, it was 2007. He said, John, if you're willing to go there for a week and spend a week, there's this habituated group of Sasquatches. I'm sure you'll see one. So I thought, well, that's a pretty good offer. So I did go there, and on about the third or fourth day, I got called from the motel out to the place where there had been some habituation going on, some feeding and a number of sightings and some tracks. Anyway, and there, in a kind of a hedgerow along a fence line facing a field, there was an upright, dark-colored mammal just standing there, rocking slowly back and forth, pretty largely obscured by vegetation. I could see a shoulder and a head. And anyway, so they thought, well, maybe they could draw it out. And so the woman who had been feeding them went out with some pancakes or something. And anyway, it didn't work. It didn't come forward. Instead, it turned around and walked smartly away bipedally. And its arm came up. And that was pretty interesting. It's kind of as you might swing an arm really briskly, just kind of on takeoff. So that was it. And there's Dennis Fole got some footage of it, not great footage, handheld through a window. We're looking out of a house. And, you know, I keep being faulted because people say, well, if you've seen one, you must talk about that more. Well, it wasn't a great sighting. And if anyone saw that footage and said, gee, if Bindernagel accepts the existence of the Sasquatch based on that, he's out to lunch. And I'd almost agree because it was not a good sighting. So I tend not to dwell on it. I mean, it was very nice. And because I accept the Sasquatch as existing, I accept that was a Sasquatch there, knowing the history and all that background. But it's not something I would bring forward like a really good track cast or something like that. But does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you can't support that with 100%, but it was just what people have to understand, too, is it's after so many years. How many years have you been doing this, John?
Well, I started in 1963, and it didn't really get into the field for a little while after that. But I mean, there's been some large gaps in there, and you know, the sitting around in the office writing the book wasn't great. So I don't know how much field time I've actually put in.
But it's piece by piece by piece that brings you to. I mean, that's how you put things together, you know, scientifically in the form of evidence. So, you had a question, Jeff, about where John had been recently.
Yes, John, you shared with me that one of your most recent presentations was at a university venue. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, I can, you know, and this was a seminar series that the university was putting on for students and the public. It's a University of Vancouver Island in Nanaimo, used to be called Malaspina University, and I got this invitation to speak alongside others talking about, you know, fossils and that sort of thing. So I did it, and, you know, I mean, great turnout, and you probably know this also, and both of you from speaking, you know, the subject really attracts a lot of people, so, you know, full house, people sitting on the steps and that, and good questions, and, you know, I just went through my 40-minute PowerPoint presentation, reviewing evidence, and you know, largely for the benefit of students, just talking about this whole thing about scientific resistance, that, you know, when a discovery claim is perceived as far-fetched or even preposterous, there is this resistance. And I don't know if that worked or not, but it was good. Yeah, it was good. And one of the things about this type of thing is that I was able to get a little bit of a video clip, a video thing on the local television, Vancouver Island does it, actually, about the day before. And, you know, there's been this trickle of reports coming in since then, and this is always the good thing, is that, you know, people realize, gee, there are a few investigators out there taking this very seriously and appearing to make sense, and maybe they'd like to know about my encounter, my observations or whatever. So, yeah, it wasn't bad. Well, what I would like to mention, Jeff, though, is something I had last year, and that was being invited to be the banquet speaker at a conference of wildlife professionals, 500 of them. Oh. And, you know, again, I gave that my PowerPoint presentation, and that was quite remarkable because there was almost no reaction. It was just almost no question. There was a few comments the next day, and it was from students, because I had talked about being skeptical or agnostic on the subject. And a couple of students said, gee, I think I might have moved, based on your presentation, from being a skeptic to an agnostic. And that is that, instead of saying, no way, I can't accept that this thing could possibly exist, I'm now saying, gee, maybe I don't have enough information. Maybe it could exist and I wouldn't necessarily know about it. So we're still in this process.
Most definitely.
Now, is there some way that people can contact you, especially on Vancouver Island, where they can get a hold of you and tell you about, you know, report their sightings and whatnot?
I've got to get back to work on my website. I think I've got my email address up there. That's what I try to do. But I get phone calls. I don't know how, you know, I am in the phone book for Courtney, Comox Valley, where I live.
Just look me up. That's old school.
I'm. Obviously, I should be a little more like you, Todd, a little more promotional, and making my efforts known. And yeah, but I don't do that very well. But I should, because I keep saying to people, you know, I am running out of time here. I do want to get on with this. I do want to still be around when we do have acknowledgement of the discovery. So I should probably work a little harder at making it happen, or helping make it happen. Anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Well, and your website could, it does seem a little bit old school. Is there an email address? Your website, if anybody's interested, I just put up a John Bitternagel video, part 1 of 3, and I made sure that on the video that's on the Sylvanic Bigfoot YouTube page, it's got his website, bigfootbiologist.org. Is that what it is, John?
That's right. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it is old school, and I am going to get some work done. I am going to start adding some blogs. Yeah. I know. I haven't been with it in social media, but I am trying.
Mm-hmm. No, we should get you on Facebook.
Is that true? That too. Yeah. And by the way, thank you for the enhancement you did on the thing I put up, the Sasquatch Illustrated lecture.
Yeah, it's a great video. People are really responding well to it, and actually, you can actually look at the comments across the bottom, because it's a very well liked. Excellent presentation, and I think people are going to like the other two that are coming up right away. So,
well, that's good. I wouldn't want to read too many negative comments. I feel I've had enough rejection in my life to, which is why I often don't invite comments.
Well, you want to get rejection. You want to get real. The people that come out of the woodwork, film the video, and then put it up and see what happens. Because believe me, I know what that's like.
I'm sorry, it's not funny. It seemed humorous. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it is. It's a little bit humorous, but I actually have been doing a lot of work with you recently. Your footage is you're one of the stars of the feature documentary Bigfoot North with Jeff, myself, and Sonia. So I think you're going to get a lot of good notoriety from that. I love the way working with you and Jeff, probably I mean, besides the scientific know-how, the wonderful perspectives that you both provided, what people can really learn from both of you is your lack of hostility, your lack of, I mean, you guys, Jeff would bang his knee and he'd go, oh goodness, you know, instead of the younger people you do stuff with. And that it's a little bit funny, but you both are such, I want to, like, wholesome, like Boy Scouts in the way you do things. And, I feel that that's, I mean, I want to teach that to my son. I wish more people, you know, these young up and comers would be a lot more like that. We've lost that good, wholesome, honest perspective on things. And it's really, it's a big concern for me, but anyhow.
Well, sorry, that's a good comment. Just an aside there, doing that second book, and it, you know, the whole thing about discovery of the Sasquatch, I learned to be more well, you wouldn't know it to hear me speak, but I have learned to be more philosophical, you know, knowing how many medical discoveries, for example, that we take for granted now, what they went through and what the early pioneers working on them went through. It was, you know, there was a lot of discoveries that were quite prolonged in being acknowledged. So, as I say, that gives me a more philosophical perspective, which should reduce the frustration. And then sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. Anyway.
Yeah, it's quite an uphill battle.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult to have patience when, and especially in the field of science, where you would expect the adherents to have some sense of the history of their own fields, and yet if they did, they would recognize that this process, which is repeated time and time again, you know, if history teaches us anything, it's that in spite of the conservatism of science, there's a constant cycle of you know, paradigm shifting discoveries that are made. And so to sit and clutch to your own narrow worldview with such
tenacity.
Yeah, there you go. That's it. Tenacity. Yeah. And not have an open mind to possibilities, to at least look at the evidence. I mean, that's why my greatest frustration comes from individuals who adopt a dogmatic opinion of something that is not based upon an evaluation of evidence. You know, so my own colleagues, you know, the ones that know the least about what I do are usually those that have the strongest opinion, and often negative, about the merits of what I do. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's extremely aggravating, because you would expect scientists to be more progressive thinkers than the way so many behave and act. Yeah.
Yeah, that's good, Jeff, because I know you go through this so much more, even more than I do. And I always tell people, you know, when people ask about your work, I say, you know, Jeff Meldrum, he's got, you know, there's this great collection at Idaho State University in Jeff Meldrum's lab, and he can't get his colleagues from down the hall to come and look at his evidence. At least that's what you told me when it was the case. Maybe it's improved.
Not much. No. And it's interesting, because your comment about the 500 professional wildlife biologists who sat there silently, that's the way the pendulum has swung now. You know, when you have, as you do as well, the endorsement of individuals like Jane Goodall and George Schaller and so forth, it's that kind of blunts the ignorant type of criticism that often rears its head. And so the alternate treatment is to ignore it. And the silence sometimes is deafening. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a phase that I've sort of entered where, you know, I'm a full professor now. I'm a senior member of the department. I am productive. And even in spite of my activities in this arena, you know, I continue to be productive in others as well. And so they can't criticize me on that basis anymore, or throw up roadblocks to my academic progression in that way. And so basically, the tact is just simply to ignore me.
Wow.
So I'd like to ask you this, John. I mean, you're a wildlife biologist with a PhD. For God's sake, why haven't we been able to make this discovery? What's going on? Why?
Well, you know, people say surely by now, you know, wildlife biologists that are out there, they would have seen one. Well, I got an interesting story about a young biologist seeing when he was out with Joe Bielart, you know, and he just would not even talk to anyone about it. He said, you want me to commit career suicide right while I'm just getting started? No way. And so there's this taboo. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff in philosophy of science, you know, that we go with, well, it's referred to as prevailing knowledge, but as someone wisely pointed out, a lot of it's merely prevailing opinion, and that's the safe way to go. Well, Jeff was kind of alluding to that. And, gee, I think we're a pretty conservative group, wildlife biologists. And, you know, and I have talked about, and I talk about it in that PowerPoint presentation. Here we have, you know, like on my desk, you know, a field guide to the mammals of North America. There's an upright bear in there, a little sort of drawing of an upright bear, but there's certainly no Sasquatch. Sasquatch is not an option. And the assumption, of course, and it's not a bad assumption, is that surely that book or that list of North American mammals is complete by now, especially for something that's, you know, weighs 800 pounds and is maybe 7 feet tall. My goodness, you know, we're not that bad that we'd have missed it. Well, I'm not saying we're bad to have missed it. But it's like Jeff says, you know, we've chosen to ignore it. It doesn't fit. It's an enormous claim.
It is. It's such a miracle that I think that's one of the biggest problems that people have, is the miracle of this most man-like primate on the planet here under our nose all this time. And something that people forget too is that this is a two-way sort of game. It's the discovery of them is they don't want to be discovered. You know, they I mean, obviously, I mean, that's a given. They're not walking out, they're not making conversations with people. And if they're trying, they're obviously not trying, they're successfully evading us, then it's almost this, I hate to say it, like a competition for what we want to do to prove their existence. And what I believe we're up against is something, a species that is so intelligent and so exceptional when it comes to tracking. They're so amazing in their environment. They've taken it to such a level that I think at the end of the day, I mean, I remember you talking about it, John, we're trying to save people's bacon because we know they're real. And at the end of the day, people are going to ask when the discovery comes out, where was the scientific discussion, right?
That's right. And that's why it's good that Jeff and I both and I stick around, you know, so that we can say, well, you know, we have been trying, folks. And you know, something I'm doing now, I'm digging out some of these old documentaries from the 1990s, and what's embarrassing is that what I'm saying now isn't a whole lot different from what I was saying then. I mean, you know, we've made so little progress. Anyway.
Mm. Yeah, it feels that way. But I think by, you know, the inroads, even though the progress is slow, there has been some refinement and some advances and some, validation of some of the evidence. And I think even though they don't publicize their interest, there are more and more academics, and I have lots of behind the scenes types of stories that seem to indicate that, that they are sitting up and taking a little bit of notice, and especially the younger generation that has not been as fully indoctrinated or as entrenched in their thinking.
Yeah, a little more open-minded, which is really what we need on this. In case either of you don't know, Angus Reid, one of the most respectable survey companies in the world, did a survey of the United States and found out that 30% of Americans believe Bigfoot is either real or very probably real. So that means there's 100 million Americans that would check, I believe Bigfoot is either real or very probably real. And that is, I mean, that was profound to me when I learned that. So when we come back, we'll have some more questions and talk again a little more with our guest today, Dr. John Bennernagel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
The Jane Goodall Institute is an organization dedicated to continuing to protect critical habitat for chimpanzees and other great apes in Africa, to work with and empower African communities to improve their lives, and to encourage young people around the world to take positive action for the planet. Go to janegoodall.org to sign a petition, get educated, and help to ensure great apes have a future on our amazing planet. That's janegoodall.org.
Conservation starts with us. Learn about environmental concerns each week when you tune in to Our Wild World with host Ellie Weiss. Our show centers on Africa each week and what's being done to save our wildlife, ecology, and ourselves. However, we'll also discuss what's going on closer to home. And most importantly, we'll let you know what can be done in our own backyards by featuring guest experts and featuring your questions and answers. Listen every Monday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The Complete Sylvanic Collection is an online download featuring videos, stills, chronicles, and audio collected by Todd Standing. It is an enormous collection of some of the most significant evidence ever recorded. Visit sylvanic.com or bigfootnorth.com to see these downloads, video footage, and to find out more about Todd's work. You can also find the Bigfoot North products for sale in the online store. Our sightings are just the beginning. Visit sylvanic.com or bigfootnorth.com and see what you're missing.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, voiceamerica.com. You are listening to Bigfoot North. If you have a comment about our program or a question for Todd Standing or Dr. Jeff Meldrum, please send an email to info@bigfootnorth.com. That's info@bigfootnorth.com. Now, back to the show.
So we're back. So Jeff, you had something you wanted to talk to John about, the project or both?
Yes, yeah, I was ahead. Just going to mention, John and I have a joint engagement coming up in about a month. One of the documentary film crews that I've been working with on a rather extended project is undertaking to do some experiments with some drone technology. And so this we're linking up with John up in British Columbia and using not as ambitious a set of technology as the Falcon project had in mind with the Aurora, but yet nevertheless it'll be an opportunity to demonstrate just what drones can and can't do in a more forested type of environment. What are the limitations? What types of wildlife can be identified? We'll do some experiments with human subjects, and I'm really excited about it. I think it'll be a great pilot study.
Yeah, it should be interesting.
And I'm tremendously interested in that as well, for the work that we're doing. John has seen, obviously it's not a secret, I work with drones as well, and John was quite impressed with my drones when he came out into the field with me, to say the least, I would think. Is that not correct, John?
I was very impressed, to the point, as you recall, of me trying to do the in-office, what do you call that there, anywhere, it didn't work for me. I haven't played enough video games to actually operate one, but I was very impressed with yours in the field.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about that, your experience with meeting me and was it 10 days that we spent together? It was quite a bit of time, I think.
Yeah, about a week anyway.
Yeah. What were your impressions? How did things go? Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, it was great for me. You're asking me that, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Please.
It was great for me. Well, you're getting to know you better, of course, and spending time with you spend time with a guy in the field, you get to know each other fairly well. We're spending all that time together, and it was nice for me being back in that foothill, lodgepole, pine country again, which I have spent time in the past in my wildlife work, but not for years and years. So that was pretty interesting. Seeing, tracks of some of the big game there, elk and moose, wolf. That was good. Seeing the habitat.
And potentially some Sasquatch tracks as well, a few of.
We saw those impressions in the moss, which could well have been Sasquatch tracks. See, I'm always so conservative about some of these things because Jeff has this lab full of really good track casts, and I've even got maybe a dozen really good track casts. And if those are not being not just accepted, people aren't, our colleagues aren't willing to scrutinize them. So I'm reluctant to raise, these impressions in moss where you tend not to get toe definition. So, although I accept that they probably are Sasquatch tracks, I just don't raise them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what I really enjoyed about, I mean, this was our first meeting, was how skeptical you were in the beginning and even adversarial about the breaks that I was showing you in the structures. And in time, after days and days of being out there, I feel like, you know, I, at the end of it, I mean, maybe you want to talk about that a little bit, how your perspectives kind of changed.
Well, you're right. I hope I wasn't adversarial. Because, you know, I quote Carl Sagan on skepticism. He was a real booster of, he said, healthy skepticism is definitely an important part of science. But then he also says, but if we're too skeptical, we will miss things, we will obstruct scientific progress. So I use those his quotes quite a bit. So I am being skeptical is not a bad thing. We just have to, you know, remain be willing for that skepticism to be overturned. And so I did have these questions, you know, those structures. I still don't know about those structures. Just because I know we have other evidence, which to me is more compelling. But I did take your point that they only occurred in certain areas, and they weren't really widespread. So they may well be Sasquatch related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent. Good. And what about the things like the apples being taken and stuff like that? How did you feel about those circumstances?
I don't know. You know, it was just that one day, you know, we came back and there were two ravens leaving, and we did find one apple which had been, you know, but that doesn't say that anything about the others. So I know Jeff knows that, and maybe he does it himself. You know, there's things I put on the shelf. There's things I say, gee, this is great. I accept this. Let's use that and move on. There's other things. Gee, I really don't know. Let me put it on the shelf for now, and we'll pull it down later when we maybe find a place for it to fit in. So I put that on this sort of metaphorical shelf just as a, gee, I just don't know.
Yeah, I have a very similar approach to things. You're absolutely right, John. And it's, for me, sometimes it's just a matter of time too, to think about it and have the time to sit and look at it from every possible angle. You know, I'm continually amazed at new insights that jump out at me, even from these footprint casts that have been, you know, kicking around here in my lab, figuratively speaking, for the last, almost 18 years in some cases. And invariably things, when the right question is asked or the right contrast is juxtaposed, suddenly jump into focus and become clear. And so, you know, when people have been hounding me for response to their various objections and questions and critiques of things that Todd has put out in the past, I try to reiterate to them, look, you know, my presence here on this radio station, my visit to his study site is not in itself endorsement of everything. It is simply that I've seen enough that my interest is piqued. You know, my interest, my curiosity was sufficient to take him up at his invitation, and as was yours, John, and to come out there and take a look, and let's see where it goes. And I'm still in; it's still a journey, not a haven't arrived at any destination yet.
Mm. Well, and I didn't expect to. I mean, this mystery is not going to be ended in a little 3-day expedition like that.
Exactly.
But it was my goal to. I worked very hard for an extended length of time to make sure that when both of you came out, it wasn't for me to see a Sasquatch or to have an experience or to evaluate evidence I already knew was there. It was about getting you two to really see what I was capable of and what my research has brought me to the level of. And it was very exciting for me. I felt it was really, really, really successful. In moving forward, I feel like this research and the people that I work with now are really, I feel like this is bringing up Sasquatch research to a level that it needs to be at. And that also includes the work that I'm doing with Les Stroud, that, you know, we had really significant success with him as well. So, and I'm super excited about the new technology, because I really believe that can take us to the next step where, I mean, my goodness, I say I can get Sasquatch to come around me, which happened, I believe, on a few occasions, especially on the episodes of Survivor Man. And now if we can track them with drones from above and all this kind of new technology, if we could see them better with our thermal vision, you know, it's really taken us up to a new level of success, and I'm very excited about it. What do you think, John, it's going to take to make this discovery? What do we need to do to really push this up to the next level? What should I be doing?
Well, obviously our colleague demand a type specimen, a cadaver. Mm-hmm. And of course, mm-hmm. that would be, excuse me, overnight acceptance. You know, suddenly it's acknowledged. Well, I don't know if it's going to take that, or if maybe the ongoing DNA studies will provide something that becomes definitive. But what I do know is that when we do reach that tipping point, and this is what interests me especially, that's when people will look back, and that's when scientific-minded members of the public will say, gee, why do they appear to be surprised that they find that the Sasquatch actually exists, you know, on the basis of this cadaver or whatever? Didn't they see it coming? Was there no scientific discussion? And that's when we come back to what I mentioned earlier. We tried to create discussion. We wrote books. We wrote papers. We spoke, you know, some of us, a small minority. And Jeff tipped me off to this earlier, and because in the investigating community, you do get a lot of criticism of the scientific community, and I say, yeah, they have been unwilling, you know, to scrutinize the evidence, but I mean, in defense of science, I think people should know that science, in a way, is working because there are a minority of us, just a handful. You know, unfortunately, some of them passed on, Grover Krantz, Richard Greenwell, but you know, some of us persist. Sorry, that's not what you asked. I got going on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me explain. I wanted you to bring up DNA because that's something I want to talk about. I've been talking to Jeff. Now I'm talking to you. I have DNA. If this can bring it up to the level where it gets acceptance, show me who to pass it off to. Right now, I will get out there. And people think, well, this is just no problem. People are going to accept it. No, I've been to post-secondary institutions that I attended school at, and they've shunned me away. I've talked to people in major the big Oxford DNA thing that was going on with Brian Stikes. I asked 20 times to be a part of that. I've got three definitive samples of Sasquatch DNA that I would stake my reputation on immediately, and they're significant samples. Where do I go? Who do I take this to? Please tell me.
Well, Jeff's the person to speak there.
And have I not brought this up with Jeff? Yes.
Well, yeah, you did. You did. I don't know if it was last week or when we were talking with.
Even in the field, I had this discussion with you as well.
Right. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And certainly, and that's on the docket. I tell you what, you know, my life is kind of in a very tight landing pattern right now as finals are upon me. And when this semester rolls to a close, I'm going to be going gung-ho on a bunch of projects, and that's right near the top of the list. So we will figure it out.
Well, I think what people don't understand is when I go to a post-secondary institution with this DNA, the problem, the resistance is that if it does come back as something significant, now they're endorsing, and I've heard them say this to me, now we're endorsing unicorns and Santa Claus. So because they really have to, and I expect this. I expect when I provide them with DNA that comes back as unknown primates, something very similar to a human, when they have those kind of results, which they can deduce at this point in history, I expect them to publicize it. And most of them will even start the conversation, well, we'll do your DNA, and I have very limited DNA. Don't think I have truckloads of it. This is an extremely rare species. We'll do your DNA, but we're not going to publicly acknowledge it. Well, what's the point then? And that is the roadblock for me, is you have to publicly acknowledge it after. Yeah. They won't do it.
Well, we'll get that taken care of. I know people who the prospect of publishing a novel DNA sequence of an currently unrecognized species would be a brass ring in their eyes. And so we'll get that hurdle overcome.
Well, and perhaps we'll get that done in our lifetime. I sure would. Yep. You know, remember, I've been trying to do this since 2006. So
well, and, let's and, let's set a goal to get it done before the summer's out.
Okay, I'm up for it. And as you know, and the other problem is they always want money. So I actually am in a position where I can pay for stuff as long as they're not asking me for $20,000 a sample, as long as it's somewhat reasonable. That's the other roadblock that I've had. So, well, it's been great talking to you, John. What's the future for you, John?
My pleasure.
What's next for you, real quick?
Oh, what's next for me? Well, that drone project that Jeff mentioned, and I've got my own camera projects going here. Just right now with the trail cameras, getting deer and elk. But that's always a good project, and you never know what else could walk into my view sometime.
Yep. Excellent. Well, so we've been talking with John Butternagle, the author of Discovery of Sasquatch and the author of the North America's Great Ape, the Sasquatch. Excellent books. If you ever have time to have a read through them, they're a wonderful read. I highly recommend them for the Sasquatch enthusiast. And anything else you'd like to say, Jeff?
No, just it's been a pleasure, John, as always, and look forward to seeing you in a few weeks' time.
Yes. Well, thank you, Jeff. And thanks and very much, Todd. I've enjoyed this.
You're welcome, and I look forward to getting you both out into the field again with me this year over a greater extended length of time to have even better success. I'm really looking forward to that. So that's it for us today. Thank you very much for tuning in to Bigfoot North, and stay tuned for next week when we'll have more exciting Sasquatch talk.
Thank you again for listening to Bigfoot North. Please join Todd Standing and Dr. Jeff Meldrum again next Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We'll have another part of the story then.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.